From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that will impact who is allowed to possess a gun. Then, during Period Poverty Awareness Week, we learn what the Milwaukee Diaper Mission is doing to address the issue.
People should have equal access to the products that they need to feel clean, dry, and healthy. I think that with 2 in 5 menstruators struggling to afford period products, this is a serious public health crisis, truthfully.
We'll get tips on how to keep pests out of our yards while encouraging pollinators. Plus, we'll share the story of Gertie the Duck, what she brought to the city, and why she has her very own statue on a Wisconsin Avenue bridge.
Milwaukeeans were so interested in Gertie. Milwaukeeans lined up along the bridge and spent hours just watching her talking to each other about what they were seeing.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. saw its deadliest school shooting in nearly a decade in Uvalde, Texas this week. A gunman carrying an AR-15-style rifle and carrying multiple magazines stormed into an elementary school, killing 19 children and 2 teachers. The situation has once again reignited a gun control conversation in the country. Last week, a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision prompted a major change in state gun laws. The court unanimously decided that a conviction for domestic violence-related disorderly conduct does not prevent someone from carrying a concealed gun or weapon under federal law. That's a big change in gun laws in the state, as previously officials interpreted a conviction as grounds for barring gun possession. The Wisconsin Department of Justice could not estimate how many people will now be able to get a concealed carry permit or possess a gun at home, but criminal defense attorney Tony Cotton says the number could be in the tens of thousands. He shares more with WUWM's Mayon Silver.
Whoever's eligible to carry a concealed weapon basically has to be eligible under federal law to possess a gun. So if you are a prohibited person under federal law, meaning you have a felony or you have a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence or you're an illegal alien, there's all sorts of categories of people who can't possess firearms. And then Wisconsin, when it analyzes who can get a CCW permit, looks to those prohibited categories to decide, okay, if this person has any of those prohibited characteristics, they can't possess a firearm, therefore they can't have a CCW permit. And that's what this decision really gets to the heart of, is it deals with those federal prohibitions and whether they apply in Wisconsin.
Right. So federal law basically prevents you from getting a concealed carry permit in any state if you're convicted of what's called a, quote, misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. What has that meant in Wisconsin for people that are convicted of disorderly conduct, for instance, which this case was about?
Exactly. So it's been, you know, as a criminal defense attorney, I've been doing this for 17 years now. And one of the earliest things I heard as a criminal defense attorney was from clients, I would hear, I can't be convicted of disorderly conduct. You know, I had an argument with my wife. I can't have a misdemeanor conviction on my record because that misdemeanor domestic violence conviction will prohibit me from possessing guns in the future. And every criminal defense attorney, I mean, if they knew what they were talking about, we were all telling our clients to be abundantly careful. Do not possess firearms in the future because you now have, if you're convicted of a misdemeanor disorderly conduct with your spouse or live-in girlfriend or boyfriend, you now have a domestic violence crime on your record. And under federal law, you can't possess a firearm if that crime involved the use of physical force. I know this decision really gets into the weeds if you try to get through the details of how they reached this conclusion, but that's how we were advising people for years and years and years, was disorderly conduct bars you from possessing a gun.
And so is that a disorderly conduct, like if the underlying facts involving it had to do with your spouse or significant other, or if you had a particular, what's called a modifier, like where it's a domestic disorderly conduct, domestic violence, and it's actually charged that way? Does that include both those types of crimes?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the typical context in which we would see this concern was domestic violence disorderly conduct. We're not talking about bar fight cases where it's just a bunch of knuckleheads fighting each other. Those weren't the ones that, you know, anybody thought prohibited gun ownership. It was that category of cases, which is the majority of disorderly conduct battery offenses, interspousal, alleged violent behavior, arguments, things of that nature. Those crimes, whether or not they had the modifier, as defense attorneys, we were always concerned that people couldn't possess firearms long term as a result of that.
So what did the Supreme Court essentially come up with? Why did they say that domestic violence, disorderly conducts don't fall under the federal law?
Federal law prohibits gun ownership if you have a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence where one of the elements involves the use or threatened use of force. And disorderly conduct is one of the strangest crimes in Wisconsin because you can commit it by being loud, boisterous, otherwise disorderly, violent, profane. There's a million of adjectives that are used. And so there's a variety of ways you can commit that crime. The Supreme Court held that disorderly conduct does not require the use of physical force. And because it doesn't require that as one of its elements, federal law doesn't prohibit you from possessing a gun if you're convicted of domestic disorderly.
Basically, the justices were unanimous in their decision in saying that the state disorderly conduct statute doesn't fall under this federal law. What's really going to be the effect in Wisconsin?
This is one of the most monumental decisions I've read in quite a long time. The immediate effect is to, if this is even a phrase, re-enfranchise, as opposed to disenfranchise, tens of thousands of people who previously thought they couldn't possess firearms now can possess firearms. One of the most common calls I get as a defense attorney on a daily basis is somebody who's been convicted of some old disorderly conduct, just like the guy in this decision from 20 years ago or 30 years ago, had an argument with his girlfriend, hasn't possessed a firearm for 20, 30 years. Now the Supreme Court has made it abundantly clear that yes, you can possess a gun if all you have is a domestic disorderly conduct conviction.
Are you pretty sure about that tens of thousands?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be, because if you look at how the majority of cases resolve, they you know, in my experience, when you have somebody charged with battery disorderly conduct, the typical plea deal, if it's not resolved as sort of a non-criminal, you know, ticket or dismissal, it's usually disorderly conduct how the case is wrapped up. And so I've just seen so many, I mean, just in our firm alone, I can think of well over 100, hundreds just in my firm of convictions for disorderly conduct as a domestic that I've seen. So I think there's quite a few, there's certainly quite a few people in Wisconsin this will apply to.
It was a unanimous decision, but Judge Jill Karofsky wrote a concurring opinion, and she recalled the facts of the case, talking about how this happened in 1993, and what happened was the defendant's wife was home alone with a 4-year-old daughter. The defendant broke through the front door, punched a hole in the glass, unlocked it from the inside. He went into her home armed with a slab of lumber. He told his wife she was dead. And then, you know, she asked him to leave, and he threatened her that if she didn't move away from the door, he would let her have it. Outside, he told her that he didn't care what would happen to her if he killed her, and he was convicted of disorderly conduct, criminal misdemeanor. So for people who don't necessarily get it, why is that not a federal crime of violence?
Sure, because federal law requires you to look at the crime itself and whether the crime generally requires the use of force. So even if a particular defendant acted forcibly or acted obnoxiously, that's not enough. What matters in the case for the analysis is, does the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence require as an element the use of physical force? Disorderly conduct absolutely does not require use of force. So you can commit disorderly conduct by shouting, being profane, being obnoxious, being boisterous. There's so many ways you can commit that crime. So I think that's why the court was unanimous. I don't think it was a hard decision for them. It's just somewhat astounding that it took until 2022 to have true clarity on this issue. And it's also astounding just to have this Supreme Court unanimously agree on anything. It's remarkable.
Judge Karofsky said that the legislature could take some actions to kind of close this loophole. She called it a dangerous loophole. What's your take on that?
I don't think it's a dangerous loophole, but she's right. I mean, if the legislature wants to narrow people's gun rights in Wisconsin, it's free to do so. I don't see the Republican-controlled legislature narrowing gun rights, but maybe I'm wrong.
And what about if a prosecutor charges and convicts someone of battery based on domestic abuse?
Yeah. So a person's convicted of a battery offense, that's a different story. That has an element that requires physical force. If the person's a felon, they can't possess a firearm. So by no means does this open the door to felons going and getting guns again. But it does deal with all those hundreds or thousands or however many people in Wisconsin have disorderly conduct criminal convictions on their record. even if those convictions, frankly, have been expunged. This would even apply to people not only who have current convictions, but even old expunged convictions still prohibited people from possessing guns. So you'd have to go back through history here. We've had expungement on disorderly conduct for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, as long as I've been alive. So you're talking just a massive number of people now who have been clearly told they can possess firearms.
So you'd call this a sea change?
Yeah, this is a massive, massive ruling. It's a sea change. It will also, if we look prospectively at the impact of this case, this will make it infinitely easier to resolve so many cases in the criminal justice system, because this was the number one hangup. This was a number one hangup on domestic violence cases where people were legitimately guilty and wanted to strike a plea deal. Many, many people who have a one-time argument or a one-time event and find themselves prosecuted couldn't resolve those cases for a disorderly conduct, even if that felt fair to them, because that would result in prohibiting them from possessing guns in the future. So because this decision has made clear that that's not a bar, thousands of cases right now in Wisconsin that can be resolved with a disorderly conduct misdemeanor plea without suffering the Second Amendment consequence that we previously thought was suffered.
Do you expect your office to be barraged with people trying to change this? What are you expecting?
I mean, I think you'll have people that once this gets out and it's somewhat more publicly disseminated, I think you'll have people calling for clarity on it to try to figure out how this applies to me. We're deluged with calls as it begins with on people with old convictions and how it impacts them. This will just amplify that.
Thank you so much, Tony Cotton, for clarifying this important Wisconsin State Supreme Court decision.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
Tony Cotton is a criminal defense attorney. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. Half of the population menstruates, but in the past year alone, 2 in 5 menstruators have struggled to purchase period products, according to the Alliance for Period Supplies. This is called period poverty, and it's a problem that's prevalent here in Milwaukee as well as around the country. The inability to afford or access period products means missing work, school, and other outings that impact a person's health and quality of life. This week is Period Poverty Awareness Week, and locally, the Milwaukee Diaper Mission is doing its part to help. On top of diapers, the organization also supplies about 12,000 period products a month. About 500 period kits were packaged on Monday alone. To share more about the issue of period poverty and how to address it, I'm joined by Milwaukee Diaper Mission Executive Director Megan Johnson. What's the primary reason people have difficulty accessing period products?
Period products are taxed like a luxury good. So tax obviously is a part of that. And I think also there's quite a stigma built up around menstruation and about access to period products. And so oftentimes folks feel nervous about asking for period products and asking for help with assistance getting period products.
So when someone is in a situation where they can't get period products, you know, what things do people often have to resort to when they don't have the proper options? And what are the consequences of this?
Yeah, so it's unfortunate because when folks don't have access to period products, they have to resort to using other items, household items like socks or toilet paper or newspaper or cardboard. And unfortunately, these items are not sanitary. And when people aren't using sanitary products to keep themselves clean during menstruation, that can lead to infection.
And also outside of the hygienic aspect, I also think about how it impacts someone's ability to fully participate in daily life.
Absolutely. And, you know, for those who menstruate, they know that bleeding is a barrier, cramps, fatigue. There are lots of symptoms that come along with our monthly cycle. And so for people who don't have access to basic essentials like period products, you know, to be able to keep themselves clean, but are also experiencing these sometimes really difficult symptoms, it can be really hard for people.
Your work at the Milwaukee Diaper Mission includes making period kits. So can you share when you started to include period products in the Diaper Mission's work and the different kits that you're providing?
Sure. So when we founded Milwaukee Diaper Mission in the middle of 2020, we at first set out to just start a diaper bank, but it became clear very quickly that families that we'd be supporting with diapers would also need help attaining period products. A lot of diaper banks around the country turn into what we call a basic needs bank. They begin to offer other items like period products, adult incontinence supplies, sometimes baby formula. So we decided in the very beginning that we wanted to offer diapers, but also offer period products to menstruators in need in Milwaukee. And we offer a variety of products. We believe really strongly in dignity of choice and making sure that people have access to every option available. And so we provide both a disposable and a reusable option in our period kits. For our disposable kits, we do a pad kit and a tampon kit because people have really strong preferences when it comes to the products they use for menstruation. And so we want to make sure we're offering different options and also in several different absorbencies, because everyone's period has different, you know, they have different amounts of bleeding. And so we offer a pad kit, a tampon kit, and then also a reusable period kit, which has cloth pads, a silicone menstrual cup, and also period underwear.
You mentioned that people could be embarrassed to ask for help or they're hesitant to reach out. So what kind of outreach efforts do you do in order to make sure people in need of these can be connected with period supplies?
So we work really closely with social service agencies who are supporting folks in need. And those agencies are mostly food pantries and home visiting agencies. So for example, if a food pantry doesn't have period products on display when individuals come in to do their shopping, they might be nervous to ask about them. And so we always ask our food pantry partners to make sure that our period kits are visible so that if someone doesn't feel comfortable vocalizing that they need it, they can at least point and say, I would like one of those, please. That's really important to us as an organization. And I think, again, the stigma is so strong still. And we really love working with our city's youth because I really believe that this next generation is going to break down the stigmas around menstruation. So we work with local high school students to not only get the word out about period poverty and collect product to be able to distribute, but also to start talking about menstruation as something that, you know, is just part of day-to-day life. It's normal for over half the population, and it's not something that should be a hush-hush conversation. It should be something that we're talking about regularly, and so that's a really important part of our mission as well.
There are moments when I travel around and you go to different public restrooms, and when you come across one that has free period products, you're like, oh, this place is quality. Like, is that your ideal landscape, that, you know, the stigma will be lessened, but that, you know, it's not seen as a luxury item, it's not taxed to such a degree, but that it is out in the open and accessible?
Yes. Absolutely. And we're currently working with a local high school student who has started a period distribution program in her school. She is a sophomore and she saw a need in her school and learned about period poverty and decided to start stocking her bathrooms with period products. So there are 9 restrooms in the high school. She has taken Kleenex boxes and filled them with period products and put them in each bathroom so that not only students, but also teachers have access to period products at all times. Her name is Destiny Robinson, and she's an amazing young woman, and we'll be working with her next school year in a pilot program to stock her bathrooms at her school with period products, because she actually got a part-time job at the mall in order to fund her period program in her school. So we're going to help her out, offer some products, and it's our goal to continue to break down that stigma and make sure products are available, especially to our youth, because a lot of people miss school and work because of their period as well. If they don't have access to those products, they're not able to go to school or they're not comfortable going to school.
And so much better than whispering amongst your friends, you know, can I borrow a tampon? Can I have a pad?
Absolutely. Yes.
So outside of supplying what products people who menstruate need, what else do you think is important to share with people who have to deal with periods?
I think it's important to share that everyone who menstruates should be given some grace. I think that because of the stigma and because of old-fashioned ideas that we shouldn't talk about menstruation, people don't feel like they're able to vocalize that they're having a hard time with their period. And I think just like if you have a cold and you stay home from school or work because you're feeling really sick, if you have a fever or runny nose or a cough, sometimes period symptoms can be worse than that. And so people should be given a little bit of flexibility and freedom when it comes to, you know, when they're experiencing severe symptoms during their period.
This week is Period Poverty Awareness Week. In your opinion, what does true period equity look like?
I believe it's access across the board for everyone who menstruates. I believe that people should have equal access to the products that they need to feel clean, dry, and healthy. I think that with 2 in 5 menstruators struggling to afford period products, this is a serious public health crisis, truthfully. And I think that we need to address it. Not only, you know, small organizations like ours are doing the best we can to address period poverty, but I think that more needs to happen in order to make significant change in this space.
Well, Megan Johnson, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about period poverty and the work you're doing to address it.
Thank you for having me, Audrey.
Megan Johnson is the co-founder and executive director of the Milwaukee Diaper Mission. Did you know that you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Well, if you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts to hear us on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll learn how a duck provided people in Milwaukee and around the world a ray of hope during World War II.
She really did become a point of interest to Milwaukeeans who were so desperate to have something fun and lovely to think about rather than the war. She had thousands of fans. She got mail. She got Mother's Day cards. She got international news coverage. People just all around the country, as well as in Milwaukee, were interested in what's happening with this duck.
But first, we'll hear from an MATC student about how he was able to overcome obstacles and barriers and earn a degree. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This month, we're hearing the personal stories of 4 MATC students, or recent grads, to shed light on the challenges today's college students are facing. In the last installment in the series, we hear from Corey Lee. He's a father of 2 who graduated in December from MATC with a degree in business management. Corey sat down to talk about his experiences with Michael Rosen. Rosen is a retired MATC professor who founded a faculty-run emergency aid program called the FAST Fund. It helped hundreds of students stay in school, including Corey.
Growing up, seeing my mom going to college, it was always the plan for me. In school, they would push everybody to go to college. Yeah, that was one of the goals. I started off at UW Waukesha. I was about, I think, 19. Ended up having a son, and then I failed my exam, my math exam. After that, I stopped going to school for a couple years, and I learned how to be a dad. And once I learned how to be a dad, I went back to school in 2017. I took off maybe about 5 years, so 2012, and then I went back in 2017. I'm a big advocate for being a role model, especially for people younger than me, such as my kids. So I went back and made sure that I finished just to show them that they can do it. There are some late nights where you have kids running around and playing with toys and things, and you're trying to get an exam done or some homework done, which can be a little challenging, but just got to have the mental toughness to push through it. And I'm not an 18-year-old, 19-year-old or anything like that. So I do know the stigma of younger kids going to school and having a debt and everything. I believe that at any age, you can go back to school. It's not a race. Go at your own pace. That's my
motto. So how old were you when you went back to school?
2017, 5 years ago, I was about 23, 24.
So what's been the most challenging for you in terms of trying to get your degree? Which, congratulations, I know you got it, actually.
Thank you.
So.
Honestly, like any other student at any school, getting up to sign up because you know how hard maybe that last semester was, and you're like, oh, I got to go through this again. But just having the willpower to get up and continue to do it. I know some people from high school might have taken some courses that carried over into college, but I didn't. So I had to start fresh and, you know, go from there. And then I had to take a couple classes. You know, you have to test into MATC or any other college. And math was, that's not one of my favorite things. So I had to take like an extra math class before I, you know, the basics, the understudy classes. So I don't know. I think that just getting up to sign up for school and actually going in and finishing is a great feat for no matter how many years you have to do it.
In terms of financial pressures, can you talk a little bit about that? How you were a working parent, independent, mm-hmm. relying on yourself.
Yeah.
A little bit. A lot of students at MATC, most of them are working, going to school, raising kids, there's a lot of financial pressures that the traditional college student doesn't have.
So, my entire family moved to Arizona 8 or 9 years ago. I ended up moving into Shorewood into like a one bedroom. It was a small apartment, but it was a starter. And the bills were like, the rent was high. I remember my lights getting turned off because I had so much stuff to take care of. The balance built up to about $650, and I have $650 at the time. And I was behind about a month or two on rent. And I reached out to the FAST Fund. And you guys really helped me out in some tough times. Being in school and not having any help from my parents or anything, like I kind of was prideful on just trying to take care of things on my own. Like a lot of students are. I've been helped by the FAST Fund at least 3 or 4 times, minimum. And I really appreciate you guys for helping me out.
Well, we're glad we could help you out, Corey.
Thank you.
And we're glad that you graduated. I mean, we saw that you, like many of the students we work with, face challenges that are mm-hmm. real. We take a lot of pride in the fact that we were able to help you
yeah.
struggle through it. But mm-hmm. if it hadn't been for your fortitude mm-hmm. and your commitment and your hard work, it wouldn't have happened. So now what are you planning on doing?
My goal now, I went right back to school for my real estate certificate for a real estate salesperson in order to take the test to become a real estate agent. So I have that, and then I have my business management degree as well as a experience in the financial field about, I believe, 13 years now. So I'm going to take all of that. Do my real estate things on the side, learn that business, and then try to start my own business, which is the reason why I got a business degree opposed to an accounting degree.
What lessons, you know, you mentioned your son.
Mm-hmm.
What lessons from your experience do you hope to impart to your sons?
The first thing is to make sure they grow up in the proper environments, starting with the neighborhoods, which I didn't grow up in a good one. It's teaching them, you know, how to work. I don't want them to feel forced to go to college, to be honest. I want them to make that decision. Maybe you can take up a trade or you can go to college. Maybe you want to go to an HBCU for the college experience. I don't know. But I feel like in my era when I was growing up, college was pushed. Let's be real. There are a lot of – when you're 18, 19, you're not financially literally like all the way smart financially. So – I think we've all been there, but I want to make sure that my mistakes aren't made by my kids. I can't say they won't make mistakes, but I'll try to minimize them at least.
Corey Lee is a recent MATC grad, and Michael Rosen is a retired professor and founder of the FAST Fund, an emergency aid program. You can hear all of the MATC student stories we featured this month at wuwm.com. The series was produced by WUWM's education reporter Emily Files with help from the FAST Fund. No Mo May is coming to a close, but hopefully its impact is just beginning. The movement is intended to help pollinators like native bees, which emerge in the spring and often find a home in our lawns. But of course, where there are pollinators, there are also pests, which not only threaten our yards, but the beneficial bugs we hope to encourage. Melinda Myers is a gardening expert and author of many books on the subject. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share some tips on keeping out pests while encouraging pollinators.
So it's a great time of year. There are a lot of things popping up in our gardens, but among them are pests, especially invasive ones. What are some of the invasive insects that threaten our gardens here in the Milwaukee area?
Well, stink bugs have moved into the area, unfortunately, and they're annoying to us. They don't hurt our house, but they sneak in to spend the winter. They're very annoying. You smash them, they smell, but they also feed on a variety of plants and damage fruit and that type of thing. So they are also a pest in the garden. One of the challenges is, as a new pest, there aren't a lot of good control options that are environmentally sound. So a couple things, just like the Japanese beetle, who's not native here and has moved in and eats our plants and causes damage. Both of those, you can knock them into a can of soapy water. It's very putzy, but it is effective. You can get a hand vac and vacuum them up and then make sure you empty the vacuum either into a can of soapy water. Some people throw it in a baggie and freeze it. I think I'd rather put them in the soapy water and then the garbage or bury them in the garden. And so those are some ways to take care of them. With the stink bug, some people have reported luck with using neem, N as in Nancy, E-E-M as in Mary. It's a somewhat of a repellent as well as an insecticide, and it's labeled as organic. Most universities have not listed that as an effective control. Pyrethrin, which is a plant-based insecticide, has some control on the stink bug, but the synthetics permethrin are more effective. You'll need to make several applications, and so, you know, one of the challenges we're having is we want to support our pollinators and all the other beneficial insects, and so we need to be very careful even when using organic sprays. Japanese beetles, as I kind of alluded to earlier, they eat holes in the leaves and they leave kind of a lacy appearance. And when you have them, they can be hundreds of them, thousands actually. The University of Minnesota found that if you keep an eye out for them and you start watching and you see a few and you control them right away, one of the good things that happens is their friends don't come and join them. And it's the damage they cause to the plants, and they damage over 300 different species, signals to the chemical the plant emits, signals to other Japanese beetles to come and feed. And so if you control that early population, it'll be a lot easier. You can, as I mentioned, knock them into a can of soapy water, vacuum them, and dump and empty that vacuum into a jar of soapy water. There is a new product. It's a Bacillus thuringiensis galleria. It's a strain of a soil bacteria. And a lot of people may have used a different strain to kill mosquitoes in their rain barrels with a product like mosquito dunk, or they may have used dipeller thuricide to kill true caterpillars on their cabbage worms. So it's a naturally occurring material that kills certain kinds of beetles, including Japanese beetles. And it's sold as beetle juice, J-U-S, so you can tell how old the people are marketing this, or beetle gone. And so obviously read and follow label directions carefully, because there are good beetles out in the garden as well. But that's another way to manage that pest too.
One of the issues, as you mentioned, is that there are good beetles, there are good caterpillars, but there are also things that, you know, might be considered a pollinator that we don't necessarily want on our plants. I'm thinking of something like hornworms, which are frequent pests for people who grow tomatoes. As we're getting into that kind of area, what's the best way to deal with a pollinator that we don't really want without killing the ones we do want?
You know, with hornworms, they're pretty big, but I'll tell you, they can blend into those plants. I usually find all the poop on the ground underneath the plant or a lot of missing leaves, and I'm like, oh, I must have a hornworm. And usually there's only one or two. So if you can find them, you can hand pick it and smash it and destroy it that way. But if you find it with these little white things coming out of the bodies, that looks like rice, little rice, pieces of rice, it's the cocoon of a parasitic wasp. So this parasitic wasp lays its eggs on the hornworm. When the egg hatches, the larva eats the inside of the hornworm, and then it pupates in forming these little rice-like little cocoons. You know, once they morph into an adult, they take off and then they infect more hornworms. So nature helps. So if you see a hornworm on your tomato plant with all those little rice-like protrusions, leave them intact because they're going to be sending out more parasitic wasps to do the damage. So the nice part about, if there is a nice part about those pests that are native, there's usually native predators for them. And that's one of the benefits nature has, a way they can take care of it. But when something's invasive, its natural predators are back in the country where it came from. And that's how they get out of whack. And that's also where they look at introducing new insects to try to control the invasive insects. And they're doing some research on that with the stink bugs as well. And so that's why we're seeing a lot of work looking at, okay, who can naturally take care of it, whether it's a chemical or another insect that can prey on those problem pests.
Well, and I think that gets to the big question that a lot of us have when we're looking into different solutions. What are some key chemicals you don't want to put in your garden, even though they may kill some of these pests?
You know, always read and follow the label directions. I always suggest that you do that when you're in the garden center because it will help determine whether you even want to invest in it. Look at what they kill. You know, if it's a caterpillar killer, you know, it's going to kill caterpillars. And a lot of those turn into beautiful butterflies. Now, with cabbage worms, it's a real specific non-native moth that lays its eggs. There's two different ones that lay their eggs on the cabbage. And that dipeller thuricide, the Bacillus thuringiensis strain, will kill those caterpillars. They would kill other caterpillars, but they're not feeding on the plant. So that's one way to isolate it. You know, just because it's organic, it is designed to kill something. So read and follow label directions because that's going to give you more effective control, but it's also going to reduce that damage that you want to avoid hurting those beneficial insects. I like to work with nature. Now, you know, my livelihood doesn't depend upon, you know, the best tomato crop ever, like a farmer depends upon it. But if I have some hornworms, I can hand pick. If I have septoria leaf spot, I can remove those leaves and try sanitation. I can wait for the ladybugs and praying mantids to move in and feed on the aphids. And so I like to kind of tolerate a little bit of damage and then let the songbirds, predaceous insects, really handle it. And I find the more I work with nature, the less I really need to depend on chemicals. And yeah, I'll have some bad years, and the Japanese beetles are one of those problem pests. Let nature handle what it can. Look for solutions like hand picking, traps, barriers like row cover. That works very well for a variety of insects that lay their eggs on the plant. And it will protect beans that don't need to be pollinated from Japanese beetles, as well as your basil.
There has been the no-mow May phenomenon in Wisconsin, but of course, pollinators don't just pop up in May, and right now you're actually involved in a project with Wisconsin Public Libraries, hoping to help pollinators all through the summer. Tell us a bit about that.
You bet. June is Pollinator Month, and so American Transmission Company and the Wisconsin Library System and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan Library Systems, we've joined forces to help educate people and inspire them to help pollinators throughout the year. So we've got several different webinars I'll be presenting, creating a pollinator habitat, inviting native bees. Native bees are so important and often overlooked. They're an important part of our pollinators and helping people identify them and not worry about getting stung because they won't hurt you. And then also managing your landscape so that, you know, if we do have problems, how do you manage them while keeping pollinators in mind? And then I'm really excited because I've got three videos, how-to videos that will be available in June for families, school groups, libraries, kids to do some projects at home, and I have activity sheets to help you along the way. So one is how to grow a sunflower. Whether you do it in a container or plant it in the ground, sunflowers are just fun plants to grow, and the pollinators love it, and it's native as well. Making a bee house, all the things you need to know to make a bee house and keep those bees safe when you're trying to help them out. And last but not least, making a container of pollinator-friendly plants, whether it's one recycled pot or it's a fancy container, plants that will help support those pollinators throughout the season and make your yard more beautiful.
All right. Well, Melinda Myers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks so much.
Melinda Myers is a gardening expert and the author of many books on the subject. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Myers is partnering with Wisconsin Public Libraries all summer, and you can find a link to more information at WUWM.com. So you know that bronze statue of a duck sitting on the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge in downtown Milwaukee? Well, we'll tell you the story behind the real-life duck that inspired it. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Spring is in full swing here in Milwaukee. The flowers are blooming and new life is emerging. And almost 77 years ago, a mother duck captured the hearts of Milwaukeeans and people around the world. She was known as Gertie the Duck. She had a nest along the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge in 1945 during World War II. Her presence offered a piece of solace to many of those during a tumultuous time in our history. People would stop on the bridge just to watch Gertie. Some even stepped in to protect her ducklings. There's a bronze statue of Gertie and her ducklings on the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge to honor her memory and what she gave to the people of Milwaukee. Amanda Seligman is a professor of history and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee. She joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to share more about Gertie the Duck.
Gertie is my favorite part of Milwaukee history. I became obsessed with Gertie when we were building the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee. Who was that duck? So it's really just fun to think about this story and how it happened. Part of it is about people's goodness and interest in animal life, and part of it is about a reporter who noticed a good story. Gertie was first recognized by the bridge tenders working along the river, and they alerted Gordon McQuarrie, who was a reporter for the journal. So he published an article in late April of 1945, and that just sort of set off this cascade where people would read the article and then they would come visit and they would want more articles. And so other reporters started covering it too. At first, Gertie didn't have a name. She was just that duck. McQuarrie started calling her Gertie. The Sentinel reporters, their rivals of McQuarrie, started calling her Elizabeth or Betsy, but Gertie was the name that stuck. McQuarrie had a real gift for storytelling, and he really anthropomorphized the ducks. So Gertie, he talked about, of course, he called her Gertie. Sometimes he called her Mrs. Mallard. There were other male ducks around. Sometimes he would report on her husband. Ducks don't get married, but which of these suitors is her husband? And then when the ducklings were born, he started talking about what was going on with the ducklings too. Not everyone seems to have been totally great with the ducklings. There were some ill-behaved children who may have been firing rubber bands at her, and somebody may have thrown a cigarette down at her nest as well, which of course worried the bridge tenders. I'm not really sure how much of that happened, if it was like just one thing that McQuarrie elaborated into a whole story, or if it was something that was a serious recurring event. The city got involved. They were concerned about what would happen when the ducklings hatched. Would they fall into the river? So they actually pumped the river because they were reducing the oil slicks that would be bad for the ducklings. There was sort of serious city money getting involved in that. Eventually, Gertie had laid nine eggs, and then she discarded two of them. Ultimately, six of them hatched. The first hatched on Wednesday, May 30th. By the way, Mallory, May 30th was Memorial Day, but it was a Wednesday. It was before Memorial Day was switched to the last Monday of May. That happened in 1971, and that was not something I knew about until I started doing this research. Now, how did they move to the lagoon? Well, people were really concerned when those ducklings hatched, because remember, Gertie is sitting on this piling. It's very narrow and small. And once the ducklings start going, they don't, like, there's no platform for them to go onto. And sure enough, they kept falling into the river. And the, of course, now we have these world famous ducklings. We can't just let the world famous ducklings die. Someone from the Isaac Walton League came and stood there with a dip net. And when the ducks started falling in, he would like pick, scoop them up and put them back in the nest. The problem was that there was a storm and one of the ducklings vanished into the river, and the bridge tenders were like, that's enough. We're going to rescue these ducklings. And they took them into the little bridge house. They moved them to the Gimbel's department store window, which was right next to the piling or next to the river where they had been born. And that was not going to be their permanent display, although it's funny to think about ducks being in a department store window. And then they like made a little parade and put them in their boxes and took them to the Juneau Park Lagoon, where they were released. One of the things I found in my research is this postcard that's in the UWM libraries that of the Juneau Park Lagoon with some ducks in it. And somebody who sent that postcard had literally circled one of the ducks and put a line up and said, Gertie. So Gertie was Milwaukee's most famous duck.
And why was there this fascination with this mother duck in Milwaukee?
In 1945, just as World War II was coming to an end, and people in Milwaukee became obsessed with watching what was going to happen with those eggs because they were in that really precarious position. Milwaukeeans were so interested in Gertie. Milwaukeeans lined up along the bridge and spent hours just watching her, talking to each other about what they were seeing. As the reporter, actually both from the Journal and the Sentinel, got her story going, people would stop as they were driving through. There were truck drivers who sort of drove through and said, I'm just going to stop in Milwaukee and just watch that duck for an hour before I keep going. So she really did become a point of interest to Milwaukeeans who were so desperate to have something fun and lovely to think about rather than the war. She had thousands of fans. She got mail. She got Mother's Day cards. She got international news coverage. People just all around the country, as well as in Milwaukee, were interested in what's happening with this duck. The other interesting little piece was, because Milwaukeeans recognize this as a historic moment, one of the aldermen tried to pass some legislation that the top of the piling had to be cut off and given to the Milwaukee Public Museum and like as stored as a historic artifact. And a couple of years ago, I asked MPM about that and they had no record of it. So I don't know what happened to the piling.
How well known was Gertie outside of Milwaukee? Did she bring comfort to other people outside of our city?
I think she did. I think there was something really appealing about her story, that Americans were delighted to have something that they could think about that was positive, something that was new. That's what we think about in springtime, right, is new life. And I think that she just hit a nerve. And that's why she's so well loved and remembered, even 77 years after she laid those eggs and those eggs hatched. I think she just really resonated at a really difficult time.
And you also mentioned that she was really famous in popular culture. How did Milwaukeeans celebrate and people outside of Milwaukee celebrate her within popular culture?
There's a whole bunch of remembrances. You already mentioned the bridge, of course, but she got remembered immediately after the ducks all moved to Juneau Park Lagoon. Both the Journal and the Sentinel, which had done dozens of stories about her, published little commemorative booklets so that you could buy the whole history of Gertie and read it to yourself later on. Then there were subsequent children's books about her. My favorite one was one that was called Quinducklets. That's one I'd love to see a copy of. The public libraries in Milwaukee have one that was published in 1959, so a good 14 years after the ducklings were hatched. There's the sculpture that we all go and take pictures of with down on the river still. That landed in Milwaukee in 1997. And I was talking to my daughter about this recently, and she was like, oh yeah, I just saw a play about Gertie. I was like, what? You saw a play about Gertie? And she found one by Claudia Haas, who has a whole series of plays about the different states. They're short plays. And this one stars a duck that she calls Bertie instead of Gertie, but it's clearly based on our Gertie the duck. So one of the things I take from that is that not only was Gertie resonating with people in 1945, but with readers and children and consumers of the visual arts for decades afterwards. I was born 25 years after those ducklings were, and I'm still obsessed with those ducks.
The fascination with Gertie, again, came at a very difficult time in the world and the country. And it just makes me think about where we're at this current moment in the pandemic, with war, with what's happening in our country. Do you think we'll have another Gertie the duck in Milwaukee, or another animal or thing that Milwaukeeans can rally behind during these difficult times?
Yeah, I think that definitely is the kind of thing that happens. This is such a difficult time that we're living through, you know, with the pandemic and then the war in Ukraine. It's very easy to be overwhelmed by how bad the news is. And sometimes, just to protect myself, I turn off the news for weeks at a time. And all I do is like read very surface headlines, and I just can't bring myself to read in. But if there's a story that is about something that's innocent, like Gertie, then I will glom onto it and I'll be like, oh, I can focus on it. I really felt how heavy it was this spring. And then it was exciting to get to think about Gertie again. And you'll notice, I think, Mallory, that there, every once in a while there is a story like this. Like, what was that gator in Chicago, Chance the Snapper, a couple years ago? And I personally love stories about like when the ducklings fall into the sewer grates and the police pull them out. I just have to go read about how nice it is to have those little ducklings and how everybody loves ducklings despite all the other conflicts in our society.
Amanda Seligman is a professor of history and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with LegFX Mallory Chang. And Gertie the Duck wraps up LegFX for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Mallory Chang and Joy Powers join me in producing LegFX each week with help from Chase Browning and Kobe Brown. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Emily Files and Mayan Silver from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager, Valeria Navarra-Viegas is our digital editor, Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. You won't hear LegFX on Monday because of the Memorial Day holiday. Instead, you'll hear a special report from American Public Media on virtual mental health care. It will explore how mental health care's urgent pivot to new technologies fared during the pandemic's critical stress test. LegFX will be back with new conversations about what's happening in the community at noon on Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.